This week on The Right Side, hashtag Welcome to Canada caused illegal border crossings. John Horgan says the drivers won't begrudge BC's carbon tax increase. Creative Math skews Alberta's fundraising numbers. And Trudeau's BC and Fort Mac trip spreads fake news about his pipeline record. This is The Right Side, episode 63, recorded Saturday, April 7th, 2018. The Misuse of Resources. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. Patrick and myself are back this week, April 7th.
April 7th, first episode of April for us, and lots to talk about this week, isn't there?
Definitely, definitely, and as we promised last week, there were no fools in last week's episode, and there will be no fools in this week's episode. But if you're joining us for the first time, The Right Side is a podcast where we aim to cut through the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media. And in doing that, we put you on the right side of the news by providing you with all the information and context necessary to do that in the mess of news stories that we see in the world and Canada today, which is ever more present than has been in recent years. And that's why we're doing what we do. So.
Exactly. And I would actually counter your assertion that there will be no fools this week, but I will leave that up to the listeners to decide if what we talk about is going to be anything foolish.
No, I think I have an idea of where you're going, but all right. So for this week, we're going to start off with our Canada story. And this goes all the way back to episode 2 of The Right Side back in January of 2017. So on January 28th, 2017, the Trump presidency was about a week old, and, you know, President Trump was starting to enact his agenda, and this included his immigration policy with the immigration ban of people coming into the U.S. from 7 majority Muslim countries. And at the time, there was a great amount of criticism in the media and wider public regarding this ban, even though former presidents Obama and Bush had both done similar things. But you know, the ban progressed and it was challenged in court at various levels. The ban ultimately ended up being modified by President Trump, and it was upheld at the various court levels. And where we're at today with that ban is that it's currently on track to be examined by the United States Supreme Court coming this June or July to get a final ruling on whether or not it is indeed constitutional and can continue to be carried out. And, you know, this was back early on in the Trump presidency, and many people on the world stage didn't know exactly how to handle Trump at the time. And, you know, this also goes into the basket of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, because when the ban happened on the 28th, he tweeted, "To those fleeing persecution, terror, and war, Canadians will welcome you, regardless of your faith. Diversity is your strength, is our strength. Hashtag welcome to Canada." And this set off a number of alarm bells within Canada. And, you know, there was talk in the media about it. We talked about it here on The Right Side. And, you know, immigration was a central point of discussion in Canada in 2017, both here on the show and, you know, in the wider Canadian public, due to the record number of illegal border crossers that were crossing into Manitoba and Quebec in the winter. And as the weather just got better last year, the number of those coming into Canada illegally at these border crossings attempting to declare asylum by crossing at an illegal point of entry and then being picked up by the RCMP, it was a huge number. And we talked about it numerous times throughout the year. And, you know, we even talked about it in regards to a bit of the Conservative leadership race, to the RCMP setting up command posts to arrest those that were coming in crossing, and, you know, even in some cases the RCMP carrying the bags of these people over to ensure that they didn't hurt themselves, because some of these places had pretty rough terrain, you know, creeks and gullies and whatnot. And I think the ultimate of it was last summer, when there was a makeshift housing center, a reception center, set up in Montreal's Olympic Stadium to house all of these people that were coming into Canada. Now, the Conservatives have long said that this issue was spurred by Trudeau's misleading tweet that he issued back in January, and that kind of sent a message to the world. And when that happened, the media and the government all said that, you know, that they had no idea why there was a sudden uptick in border crossers coming into Canada. And they, you know, they attributed it to the change in the U.S. domestic policy, which, I mean, is a fair guess to do. But at the same time, any pointing of this to the tweet and, you know, the general open door policy that Trudeau espoused with that tweet, those were kind of shot down by the media. So we're going to fast forward to today, April of 2018, where we have the headline, Trudeau tweet caused influx of refugee inquiries, confusion within government email reveals. This came from the National Post, and, you know, we didn't really hear much about this week. And, you know, when it comes to access to information requests, those have the power to reveal a lot of information about what's going on in the government. And that's what this article does. It uses this access to information request whereby the media or opposition parties or anyone really can put in a question to the government, and the government needs to respond within a reasonable amount of time. And that's where this information came from in the National Post. So the article ultimately reveals that the tweet caused confusion, and many people on the international stage at consulates and, in fact, international commentators were wondering if Canada was actually going to take all the refugees that the U.S. would not. And in these emails, you can see the response to the Canadian government here. One of the early emails that was exchanged, because at the time, the consulates abroad were even asking the government back home here how to respond to this. So this email said, "We are receiving an increasing number of inquiries from the people about requesting refugee status in Canada, and a number clearly having links with our Prime Minister's tweet this weekend. A significant number of the inquiries received since the weekend have been from nationals of the U.S. banned countries, but we are also receiving them from all nationalities, both through emails and directly at our reception." Now, the key point in this email exchange here is at our reception. Typically, when the border services talk about at our reception, this means at one of the border receiving points where people can come into Canada. The article doesn't say it, but if you think about a point of reception in Canada, that is either a port, an airport, when people land and they talk to customs and border enforcement, or at one of the actual border crossings on our land border with the United States, because that's our only land border. And as we know, there were also points of reception after the RCMP intervened at these makeshift border crossings that were set up. So that's really the key point here, at our reception, because the article doesn't say it, but this means that our ports of entry, the airports, the ports, and the land borders, and even the illegal land borders, they started seeing an increased number of refugee claims. And this is, of course, coming in mainly from the U.S. on the ground, but also people who are flying here attempting to get refugee status right off the bat because of this tweet. So when you think about Canada, our biggest border is, of course, with the U.S., and then you have the subsequent airports in areas like Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal, just to name a few of the big ones. So those are all points of entry that were handling this. Now, the response to this was slow, and the government had no real response until a few days later, on February 2nd, where the government said, "We are working with the United Nations Refugee Agency, U.S. officials, and our missions abroad to clarify the current situation and determine what our next steps might be." So, as you can see here, even 4 days after this happened, 5 days after this happened, there was no real response from the government on what was happening with this. And I think we also touched on this quite a bit during the show, in that the RCMP, and in particular Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale and his team, were really far behind on what was happening at these border crossings in Manitoba and Quebec. So what we were seeing in the media and what was happening on the ground was known to be an actual case as far back as February 2nd. Now, the article also does one other thing with this. The article maintains that conservative politicians would go on to blame the tweet for encouraging an uptick in irregular crossings by asylum seekers. But I'd like to redirect everyone back to that key point at our reception. That effectively means that people who were saying that the tweet was to blame for the increased number of refugee claimants at our borders and the irregular crossings was actually true with the point at our reception. But here, even in 2018, the article says that people were just using this as a talking point or a wedge issue to try and say that this was that this wasn't actually one of the causes of the refugee surge coming into Canada that we saw in 2017. And it's just utterly baffling to see this in the article when they mention in one of their quotes from the border services and then a few paragraphs down below, we see them say, oh, conservative politicians would go on to blame the tweet. Well, I think it's quite clear based on the email response and the wording at our reception shows exactly what was happening there. It doesn't exactly take a genius to connect the dots and figure out what at our reception means.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's fascinating how over a year and a half later that they're still trying to figure out why exactly all these people were showing up at the border crossings and unregulated border crossings, when they actually did articles at the time that showed that them talking to these illegal border crossers and asking them why they showed up. And a lot of people brought out a phone and said, because your prime minister said we could. And they pulled up the tweet and said, you're welcome to come to Canada. So they went to Canada. I mean, there was no more clear cut than that. They thought they would get kicked out of the United States. So they decided to go to the next best place that they could. And yeah, that was Canada.
Yeah, this is dishonest journalism by the Canadian media on this. And we saw lots of that during the whole border fiasco last year. It's just not good. And that's, one of the things I think early on that we labeled fake news in regards to this, because it's in the emails that were sent. The people who were crossing were saying it, and now we get the confirmation and the access to information request that they knew this on February 2nd.
Yeah, and I think there's something else that's very important to note here is that something that our listeners probably know as well, and that's Canada is really big, and we have a lot of places that you can actually get into Canada. So it's hard to regulate all of that. It's not like it's a tiny country where there's only a few border crossings. Like, our border with the United States is the longest land border in the world, and it's crazy how the government just did not have such a huge response at the time and didn't really respond to this very swiftly because they didn't think it was going to be a problem. And quite clearly it turned into a big problem, and it's still a problem. They're still not really fixing it very much. And the media just is not talking about it whatsoever.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that Justin Trudeau does. And I think we'll see that talking side of him that causes unintended consequences later on in the episode as well. So What do you got for BC this week?
So in BC, this past April Fool's Day, on April the 1st, British Columbians were treated to a particularly absurd statement by our Premier John Horgan, except it was no joke. He was speaking on the first of four annual increases to the BC's carbon tax, which is, of course, already the highest provincially, and about how that would add to already astoundingly high prices. Said Horgan, quote, "I don't believe that British Columbians begrudge that penny a litre when they know it's going towards making sure that future generations have an environment that's sustainable and a world that we can all live in." So I bet he didn't really ask too many about what that would add and what people would actually think about that. I mean, one would just have to go down to a local gas station to find out what BC drivers thought of the Premier's comments. In an article in the Vancouver Sun, one was quoted as saying, "That's bollocks. That's completely ridiculous. Gas prices are some of the most expensive in the world, much less anywhere else in the country." Said another, "It's a tough, tough situation for people that drive on a daily basis." Yes, the carbon tax actually, on paper, it only added 1.22 cents per liter to gas prices, but that wasn't all that's been adding to the prices lately. As the companies tried to avoid the new tax cutting into their profit margin, it's been said time and time again that costs are either added onto product prices or covered by reduced benefits or wages for their employees. So in this case, gas is pretty much an essential item for many people, and so the cost of the tax gets put onto the gas prices. Now, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is also aware of the hit to drivers. Said Chris Sims, BC Director of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, he says, quote, it costs about $5.99 in carbon tax alone for the average family sedan. A Dodge Ram pickup truck costs more than $10. And you've got those Super Duty diesels, which are $17 every time you hit the gas station. Now, she believes that the tax hike could also put a crimp into our delivery sector, as all necessities one need to live every single day get delivered from a truck. She says most of those trucks have two cylinders, and you're already approaching $100 in carbon tax every time you're filling up. So that's really had a dampening effect on our behavior, on our economy, and our ability to get our lives delivered.
Let's not also forget the diesel trains that move goods from the Port of Vancouver across BC and across the country.
Indeed. I mean, yeah, it just comes down to it is that most of our goods get transported to us by trucks, and those trucks use fuel, and that fuel now has an increased tax on it, which means the price of all those goods are going to go up. The price of everything is going to go up because of that, and that's something that the government, I don't think, has really taken into account. And or maybe they have. Maybe it's even worse, because also beginning Sunday, the province will no longer return the entire carbon tax to British Columbians through tax rebates. Some of the money collected will now be used to fund new green initiatives, apparently, but there's no guarantee of that, and most of the tax money is now expected to go into general government revenue. So once again, we see another NDP government, much like the Alberta one, where they're spending more and more, and they're raising taxes to cover those costs. And they're trying to say, well, let's see Horgan's quote here, going towards making sure that future generations have an environment that's sustainable in a world that we can all live in. Apparently, that translates directly to the government raising more tax money for itself. So that's a little bit disingenuous, that's for sure. And, you know, we're getting into April now, and it's weather starting to get nicer in lower mainland BC, and of course over here on the island as well. So we have to remember that about a week after the carbon tax increase takes effect, drivers can now expect yet another jump at the pumps, which could push prices over an unprecedented milestone. Dan McTeague of GasBuddy.com says that in about 7 or 8 days, we will be transitioning from winter to summer gasoline, and that will add another 4 cents per liter. So it doesn't really matter where you are. He says, expect to look at Vancouver being 160.9 per liter. Now, listeners across the country might think, wow, how on earth do you pay that much? But that's just reality, because when you have to get somewhere, you have to use gas, and all gas places generally charge the same, so you have to get it either one way or another. So one wonders what the other main party in the legislature thinks about this. Andrew Wilkinson's BC Liberals have been absent from the news lately since their opposition to the province's new housing speculation tax, which I talked about a couple weeks ago. And despite being the largest party in the legislature, they're completely absent on matters of energy, despite representing most of BC that's affected by energy issues, such as rural BC, northern BC, eastern BC, and a lot of other places that are outside of either the island or the lower mainland. Now, it's practically unheard of in a minority government situation for the opposition to be silent on an issue that appears week after week. And we should be hearing from all parties on this major issue, not just the governing one. So that's either the fault of the parties themselves for not taking a stand, or it's the fault of the media for not covering them. So with no progress on the pipelines, which, of course, we've been talking about week to week, rising gas prices is not really something that's going to be going away anytime soon. So it looks like British Columbians will have to pay just a little bit more every single day to enjoy our beautiful province.
And with them hitting 160.9, you can imagine how far they would jump up if those measures proposed by Rachel Notley and Jason Kenney to cut gas shipments to BC actually happened, because this is before any of that would ultimately come into place here. And, you know, in regards to the BC Liberals, there's also the issue with that. You know, if you want to be premier, you need to be able to control the news cycle. And that is perhaps one of the first missteps of this opposition being led by Andrew Wilkinson, because issues that involve money, those are something that everyone who drives a car is going to be acutely aware of. And by not getting in on this week, that is a huge missed opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like they're still trying to figure out themselves after what happened in the last election. But here we are. This is almost a year later. They should have figured themselves out by now.
Yeah.
They have a new leader, and they've had a new leader now for about a month or two, and they still haven't really talked about very much. So it's time for them to get out there and do something.
Change the conversation.
Yeah, or even just to show the other side of that conversation.
Yeah.
And we're not getting that at all. We're just getting what the media tells us and what the media tells us the government tells us, which is basically the same thing.
And when you have the media based in downtown Vancouver, it's obviously going to be a different perspective than the media that might be in Kamloops or Prince George or somewhere out in the interior.
Exactly.
So, all right. Well, that's definitely not some good news there. We're going to jump over to Alberta right now, and with what could effectively be called here a fake news story from the Edmonton Journal regarding this and other media outlets. So the headline here was that Alberta NDP tops 2017 party donations with $2.11 million raised. So fundraising totals for the year 2017 were released this past week. And, you know, it's not uncommon to see lines such as Alberta NDP tops 2017 party donations with $2.11 million raised, or Alberta NDP tops 2017 fundraising, but the UCP came close with only 5 months of donations. The second one, of course, from the CBC, the first one from the Edmonton Journal. And the Edmonton Journal notes that about $1.2 million worth of the NDP's donations came from donations larger than $250. Only $504,000 of that came from donations smaller than $250. Now, you might be wondering, why is this $250 threshold important? Well, if you look at day-to-day citizens, day-to-day Albertans, and day-to-day Canadians, people don't have typically more than $250 to throw away at this time of year to donate to a political party. So in general, smaller donations mean that they are coming from individuals, and those individuals are getting involved in the political process and want to see the political party that they're donating have a positive impact in the election to come. And when you see this ratio here, $1.2 million coming from donations larger than $250 and $504,000 coming from smaller than $250, you can see here that the NDP is going after the richer segments of population who might have interests within the government, compared to day-to-day Albertans who are getting involved with the NDP platform, getting involved with the NDP, and chipping in a little bit along the way. And you also saw this in the U.S. election in 2016, because Bernie Sanders, I think his average donation was around $17 per shot, whereas Hillary Clinton's donations were much higher for that party. So you can see the different level of engagement that were present in those campaigns, and that was deeply noticeable in the way that those two candidates performed. And that also precipitates here, because a person who is going to donate less than $250 is more likely to be an individual just interested in what the party is, compared to someone who is, you know, throwing $500 at the donation. Now, there's a major clincher with this story, though. And, you know, these articles show that the NDP is first. Well, the entity known as the NDP was first in the amount of donations that came in. There should have been some simple math that actually showed the true picture of what was going on in these articles. Throughout 2017, the Progressive Conservatives raised $1.84 million. The Wild Rose raised $1.2 million. The United Conservatives raised $1.12 million. This is a total of $4.16 million. For the what has effectively become the conservative opposition in Alberta. And when you look and you compare that to the amount that the NDP has raised, that's almost half the amount, or double the amount that the NDP has raised. Elections Alberta ultimately provides no means for parties to transfer funds between one another. So when the United Conservative Party was formed last summer, the cash on hand of both the Wildrose and the PCs had to be liquidated and used for other things. They couldn't be ported over to the new party. So this is a huge amount of money to be raised by what is effectively the combined forces of the opposition in Alberta. The story that was also missing from these articles is that the purpose of the Alberta Party leadership race was to generate interest and revenue for the party, but they failed on the latter. The leadership race started in November of 2017, but the party only brought in $215,000 for the year of 2017. As was the same with the NDP, these numbers were from donations larger than $250 to the tune of $104,000, and $27,000 of the total $215,000 for the Alberta Party donations of 2017 came from membership sales. So while the leadership race for the Alberta Party did cross over into the new year, 2018, the numbers are still ultimately low compared to that of the NDP and the United Conservatives. For comparison's sake, the Alberta Liberals, who are also in a similar situation as the Alberta Party, raised $237,000 in 2017. The United Conservatives raised $613,000 from donations and contributions of less than $250. The former Wild Rose Party raised a total of $513,000 from donations and contributions less than $250. The former Progressive Conservative Party raised $136,000 from donations and contributions less than $250. So when you combine this, this is roughly $1.2 million raised by the conservative parties in Alberta of contributions that were under $250. So this leads us here to the greater picture that the NDP's income largely comes from fundraisers and contributions of greater than $250, while the opposition's is coming from the $250 or less bracket, which means that day-to-day Albertans are getting more involved with the opposition conservatives than they are with the NDP.
Yeah, I think the fundraising numbers on the whole, they look like they're a lot of everyday Albertans getting more and more involved with the former Conservative parties as well as the United Conservative Party. But I think a greater thing to note here is just the reason why that's important, because a lot of people would look at these numbers and say, oh, great, politicians are getting more and more money. But really what it comes down to is these are almost like polls in how you can predict how each party is going to do in the coming future. Generally, a candidate or a party that's able to outraise money on another party is generally able to have more money to spend on advertising and campaigning and all things like that, which will help that party get elected. We've seen this more and more often, more lately than it has been in the past even. So this is something that's pretty important, even though it, on the whole, it doesn't really seem like it's that important. It's actually quite a bit.
Indeed. And, you know, this is going to be an interesting thing to note for the coming quarters in 2018 as well, and as we head into the 2019 election, because, you know, money speaks, and you can't count out Jason Kenney to know how to fundraise, because you just have to look at the results of the Federal Conservative Party while he was involved with that party in terms of fundraising. So it should be very interesting to see what happens in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
All right, what do we got for firing line?
Okay, so our firing line, we have to talk. You know, last week I mentioned that I wasn't going to talk about pipelines anymore for BC. Well, I kind of cheated on that, and I'm now talking about it for firing line instead. So one has to wonder exactly what Trudeau thinks he's accomplishing politically with his odd stance on pipelines. I mean, you have to remember he was in Victoria and Vancouver on Thursday, and he assured protesters that are angry over his decision to approve the Trans Mountain Pipeline that the environment comes first, and he originally came to Victoria and Vancouver to tout Ottawa's 10-year, $1.5 billion ocean protection plan, but he ended up speaking more about Trans Mountain instead, and how the pipeline wouldn't be approved without what he called, quote, environmental confidence. Now, during his stay in Victoria, he donned raincoats and had a photo op where he looked very pensively at a section of rope on the Sir Wilfrid Laurier Coast Guard ship. Now, in Vancouver, he had a $1,000 per person fundraiser, which, of course, he invited the media to in a way to that he could spread his open and transparent government. Now, of course, that media being there were able to catch all the protesters that were just outside the building chanting, quote, "leave it in the ground," referring to oil from Alberta. Now, it's not a question of pitting environmental interests against economic ones, Trudeau argued, but he said instead it involves doing a balancing act that includes carbon pricing, protection of the oceans, and approval of the Trans Mountain expansion. He says, quote, "we need to build a strong economy and protect the environment at the same time. What we're focusing on doing is not trying to please everyone. What we're trying to focus on is doing the right thing for our communities, for our country, and for our future." So, after that very interesting visit to BC on Thursday, the very next day, just yesterday, he was meeting with workers in Suncor's Fort Hills mining facility just north of Murray to assure them that the pipeline would be built because it was, as he's always said, in the national interest. Now, he dressed the part this time as well, donning a blue collar shirt, jeans, a hard hat with some gloves, and eyeglasses, of course. And he was climbing into the helm of a Komatsu 980E heavy hauler, which is used at the mine, to add another look to his growing repertoire of dress-up fashion photo ops. Now, Trudeau acknowledged that there were people in Fort McMurray who saw his environmental policies, particularly towards carbon pricing, as the reason major pipeline projects have yet to be built. The number of foreign oil companies have left the oil sands in the last few years worried him. He asked how Ottawa would bring these companies back to Alberta. Trudeau replied, quote, "we do need to do a better job on getting an international investment. We're going to be able to do that as we move forward on NAFTA, as we create better trade deals, and as we demonstrate our capacity to get big projects like the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion built." So Trudeau's odd stance has seemingly alienated both provinces quicker than his father ever could. By approving Trans Mountain, he risked losing his party's seats in the Lower Mainland that he just gained back in the 2015 election. And he probably won't win any voters in Alberta either. I mean, let's be real. Trudeau has a reason as to explain as to why we're in the situation that we're in right now. He said, quote, "for 10 years, Stephen Harper's government talked up the oil sands but couldn't get it done. I think it's important to remember that we are exiting a time in which for 10 years, the government did everything it could to talk up the defense of Alberta's interest, but because they were not bringing the public along on protecting the environment, were unable to get much done concretely in protecting Alberta. Their lack of any sort of responsibility on the environment didn't just hurt the environment, it hurt the economy." To which Alberta UCP leader and former Harper cabinet minister Jason Kenney quickly replied with a tweet saying that Trudeau was, quote, "demonstrably false. Trudeau is the one who killed Northern Gateway and scuttled Energy East and is failing to fight Trans Mountain extractionism," end quote. Now, Kenney also pointed out that four major pipelines were built and improved under Harper. The non-XL version of Keystone, which runs from Alberta to Nebraska, was improved in 2006 and completed in 2010. And also the Alberta Clipper to Wisconsin was approved in 2008 and active in 2010. He also mentioned that the changeover in the Line 9, which was taking oil west to east, was also approved and activated under the Tories. So how did we get to this point where Trudeau and the media was saying that Harper and the Harper Conservatives couldn't build pipelines? Well, according to the Financial Post, a cavalcade of journalists alongside federal and provincial politicians on the left actually helped to make that happen. First was Max Fawcett, who is the former editor of Alberta Oil Magazine. He tweeted out, quote, "Dear Conservatives, it was Justin Trudeau and Rachel Notley that got a pipeline to Tidewater. Enjoy your cognitive dissonance." Then a CTV TV panelist said that the Tories had provincial support for federal backing, but, quote, "never got it done on pipelines." So once again, back on the news, Alberta's NDP picked it up and amplified its importance with Environment Minister Shannon Phillips spreading a tweet from a Liberal activist, quote, "So in the end, it took two progressive governments working together on climate change to get pipelines approved and do what the Conservative governments could not." Now, the story at this point went on to become so viral before anyone actually fact-checked it that even the National Post's own columnists wrote that Trudeau, quote, "got a job done that Captain Oil Sands Stephen Harper couldn't." How, quote, frustrating for the Tories. So, as Ali Tegva of the Postmillennial writes, quote, "this capacity for the Prime Minister and the multiple levels of government to easily spread fake news with near to no repercussion for most mainstream outlets is a serious problem. Ideological comfort with the Prime Minister or politicians on the left should not lead journalists into a position in which they're blind to the same spreading of a false narrative that they attack the right for. It's time we hold all politicians to the same standard when it comes to facts and telling the truth." Now, at the same time, it's fascinating to watch Trudeau, who's, of course, 2.5 years into his own majority government mandate, to continually blame a previous government for his own inabilities. It's like watching a train wreck, to be honest. In just 1 week, he's managed to both annoy his base voters in BC, Alberta oil workers, oil companies, and environmentalists alike. Perhaps the next time Trudeau should just stay home. After terrible trips to India and China, he can't even manage a trip to Western Canada without blame. However, as we note, next week he's going to be traveling to Peru for a few days before jetting to France and the UK. Now, let's keep our fingers crossed that he manages to put his socks on properly before he goes.
Oh, boy. All right. You know, this story is... It's just utterly baffling because we're in a point here where... You see Justin Trudeau out and about, and you know I appreciate the line you put in regarding the dress up, because it's almost as though he has a different outfit or a different costume for each event, no matter where he might be, and that just doesn't convey a level of seriousness when you look at him. Now, the second issue regarding this, he is entering his third year into a majority government mandate, a very big majority. As well, compared to past majorities, it's not, you know, a 5 to 10 seat majority. It was a decently sized majority. So, with that being said, I think at this point it's safe to stop blaming Stephen Harper for these issues. That's doing good to no one on this. And I think, you know, there's normally a thing within Canada that former prime ministers don't necessarily get involved in the government of the subsequent prime minister that comes in. But I think when you're being personally attacked 3 years after an election, that might actually be warranted. Or maybe even just some kind of defense on the side from Jason Kenney. But, you know, this is just really head-scratching how no one managed to check the facts. And here we are, a humble little podcast pointing out what pipelines were actually approved under the former government. And the biggest one is Northern Gateway, because that was approved and ready to go, except it was canceled. Same thing with Energy East as well. You know, those could be realities today, but they're not because of this government. And I think that maybe it might be time to drop the gloves a little bit in regards to the two prime ministers being... amicable towards each other.
Yeah, it's just absolutely baffling how Trudeau and his team are able to actually peddle these fake news stories upon the public without doing any fact-checking and without the public being able to do any fact-checking on this. People will look at this and think, oh, Trudeau's making pipelines happen. But is he really making pipelines happen? Because he canceled two and then approved one, which is, you know, under heavy protest. He's saying that Stephen Harper couldn't protect the environment, and he couldn't get people to believe that he would protect the environment. Yet at the very same time, there are protesters in Burnaby right now getting arrested because they don't believe that Trudeau will help protect the environment from the pipeline. So it's like hypocrisy is coming from all angles, no matter
There's
what
two
side
different
of the
stories
spectrum.
Happening.
There's like like, it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, whether you actually want the pipeline or not. It seems like Trudeau is trying to fool everyone. And that's what I said earlier about there may actually be an April Fool in this one. And that seems to be that this one is Trudeau and his team that are able to continually talk about these facts that are just not true.
Yeah, definitely. And that's probably going to hurt him, because if he's not seen as credible by any one side, people are going to look for alternatives when election time comes around. And just a bit of clarification on the story, we did say he canceled Energy East. It was the policy by the government that new pipeline projects in Energy East would have fallen under that, would need to take their upstream emissions into count when they build the project. So that means not only the pollution from Energy East being built, but also the pollution that the products that would be created with Energy East would have also needed to be taken into account by the company building Energy East. So that's why we said Trudeau canceled Energy East as well. It was his actions with the NEB that spurred that.
To be fair, we didn't actually say that he canceled Energy East. We just said that he scuttled it, and that's exactly what he did, was through all the extra regulations that he tacked on to Energy East. What he did there is he made it so that the company had no profitable way to get the pipeline built. So they, I believe it's TransCanada that was in charge of Energy East. They just said they'd pull the plug because there was no way that they could move forward on it. So in a way, Trudeau was able to play both sides. He was able to say, "Well, look, I tried to get the pipeline built, but it just didn't work." In another regard, he's able to say, "Yeah, I was able to hold the companies to account and make sure that these oil companies could protect the environment." So in a way, nothing gets done, and he still looks good from both sides. And I think people are starting to realize what he's actually doing with all this. And it's just amazing that the media itself hasn't picked up on this.
That's right. And we can go into our word of the week now with that. The word of the week this week is resource, which is a stock or supply of money, material, staff, or other assets that can be drawn on by a person or organization in order to function effectively. A country's collective means of supporting itself or becoming wealthier, as represented by its reserves of minerals, land, and other assets. And of course, resources here, Canada's natural resources.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of resources that we could be talking about here. We could talk about the carbon tax and how that's ultimately taxing the small amount of resources that BC is going to be getting for its drivers. We could talk about Alberta with the resources that each party is being able to fundraise and how just simple math can actually produce a different headline to what is actually being put out by the media. We could also talk about the resources of the internet and how politicians are able to use Twitter to disseminate news and their own platforms. I mean, we see this quite often with Trump, but Trudeau does it as well. And for better or worse, what's happening there is definitely quite interesting. And of course, resources when it comes down to our pipelines and our environment is itself is a resource as well, because Canada is known as quite a beautiful country, but it's our job to take care of it, but it's also our job to help Canada prosper. So with that said, that's our word of the week.
Makes sense. It's a good word. All right. If you guys want to find full show notes for this episode, you can do that at rightsidenews.ca. You can also find us and subscribe on iTunes at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at rightsideca, where we post the show and any other stories that we're looking at working on throughout the week. So give us a follow there if you want to keep up with the stories throughout the week. But until next week, we'll see you then for another episode of The Right Side.
And we'll always continue to make sure that we cut out that bias and sensationalism that you'll see in the mainstream media, that we show you week after week what they're doing. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode. Take care, everyone.